At Sephora, we know how you love to use makeup, skincare, hair care, and fragrances that work for you, but also how important it is to be in the know about the ingredients that are in them, which is why we created Clean at Sephora. Curated products from brands like Merit, Amika, Summer Fridays, and Fleur that have everything you want, minus certain ingredients you might not. Clean at Sephora is only at Sephora. Shop now at Sephora.com.
Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Moneymaker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Moneymaker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hi, and thanks for listening to New Books in Jewish Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, David Gottlieb, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Paul Mendes Flohr on the verge of retirement from his position as Dorothy Grant McClure Professor of Modern Jewish History and Thought at the University of Chicago Divinity School. Our subject is Professor Mendes Flohr's Martin Buber, A Life of Faith and Dissent, published earlier this year by Yale University Press as part of its Jewish Lives series. I am speaking with Professor Mendes Flohr in the lofty and somewhat echoey halls of Swift Hall, the site of the University of Chicago Divinity School. And in the spirit of full disclosure, I should note that Professor Mendes Flohr was my dissertation advisor here at the University of Chicago Divinity School. Professor Mendes Flohr, thank you so much for joining me today.
You're welcome. I should underscore that my interviewer, or interlocutor, David Gottlieb, was a superb and very attentive and studious and thoughtful exemplary doctoral student.
You are far too kind. So, Professor Mendes Flohr, you quote Buber as saying that if one were to write his biography, it should focus on his thought. Your book takes us along the sweeping dual arcs of Buber's intellectual development and his life experience, and it shows us not only his vast influence on a number of intellectual fields such as translation, political philosophy, philosophical anthropology, sociology, theology, and so on, but in political realms such as political Zionism, Arab-Jewish relations, and more. Your research is meticulous and extremely wide-ranging. My first question for you in the writing and research of the subject of a person who so greatly influenced 20th century religious and intellectual endeavor is, how did you go about researching this? What sources did you consult? And were you able to access sources that were not, prior to that, widely available?
Yes. First, I'd like to say something about the statement Buber felt that we should just focus on his thought. On the other hand, he also acknowledged that he was a complex person. And his thought reflects that complexity. As one says, every text has a context. The challenge of a biographer is to weave the context and the text, not to be reductionist, not to over-psychologize, which I don't have that prerogative, although, of course, I do suggest some psychological ground for Buber's thought. And that is based on what he writes. Also, my knowledge of his family. I didn't know Buber personally, but I was very close to some of his more intimate friends, and later to Buber's son, with whom I had a very special relationship that lasted last 15 years of his son's life. And indeed, every day I had what the Germans call Abendbrot with Raphael Buber. Abendbrot is like 4 o'clock tea, but virtually every day. And he sort of adopted me as his son. Certainly we were very close. And in our conversations, which dealt with, of course, his father's legacy, but also dealt with his father's relationship to him, Raphael, and his sister, and more intimate details. So I have a certain familiarity with Buber, although I never knew him directly, but I knew the family well, very well. Not only Raphael, but his children, his daughters, and ultimately his grandchildren, with whom I'm still in contact.
Were you able, through your friendship with Raphael or through other means, to gain access to materials that others had never seen?
Yes, indeed. Documents, that's the reference, but also to intimate details about the dynamics of the family and their relationships. And much of this, of course, reflects a certain, like every human relation, family relationship, certain ambivalence or ambiguity, which gave me a greater insight into the person who bore the name Martin Mordechai Buber. My familiarity with Buber goes back to my dissertation, doctoral dissertation, and I wrote it under the supervision of one of Buber's closest disciples. And so I've been living with Buber, so to speak, sounds like 60 years. In some basic sense, Buber and I have had a dialogue, if you wish to put it that way, over those six decades. And through Buber, the dialogue with the world, which he sought to come to terms with. The reality, the tortured, often tortured reality of Jewry in the 20th century, the tortured reality of that marked his life. And I begin with that, as you perhaps recall.
Yes, and I'm very interested, as long as we're talking about the dynamics of Buber's family, that though you do, in a very disciplined way, avoid psychologizing, you note the profound impact on him of the sudden departure of his mother at a very young age. And you come back to that at certain points through the book. If one may be allowed to consider this as an influence on his life and thought, how did it influence him?
Yes, certainly. Just to inform your listeners or the audience, when Buber was all of 3 years old, his mother suddenly left the home without bidding goodbye. He ran to the window, huge fenced French window, that was typical of that part of Vienna where they were living. And she never turned around to acknowledge his desperate attempt to make contact with her. And that remained true throughout his life. To the very end of his life, at the age of 87, he recalled the fact that his mother was absent. She didn't die. She just disappeared and left a huge, huge hole and was never really, hole is perhaps the, well, a clearly sense of abandonment, never really left him. And it perhaps explains why human relationships were so crucial to him. Not just what we call friendships, certainly not in the American sense that compels or even the Israeli understanding, but relationships of perduring and enduring trust. And if I understood his book, I and Thou, which is translated in a very, almost ecclesiastical sense, Thou in German is the personal pronoun of du, which is reserved for the most intimate relationships. And it was very difficult to maintain those, even if one would say do, but the genuine existential ground of a mutual trust. And that I somehow understand to be the leitmotif of his life.
Indeed, you note and do a wonderful job of chronicling the series of deeply felt and long-lasting relationships he had throughout his life, not least, of course, with his wife Paula and the mother of his children, but with Gustav Landauer and Franz Rosenzweig and others. If there is a pattern to these relationships, what is that pattern?
Yeah. You know, in German, you make a distinction between the more intimate pronoun, second person pronoun, you, as we say in English, and the more formal, sie. Buber and his, other than his wife, was very hesitant, was very difficult for him to reach a plateau of, if you wish, interpersonal plateau and trust of a due relationship, of a personal pronoun, simple pronoun, which is translated as thou, somehow to capture the theological dimension, because when we turn to God, although he's referred to in the Jewish tradition as the king of the universe, the sovereign of the universe, Melech HaOlam, Ribono Shel Olam, we turn to God with the intimate pronoun, du. So to translate is one of the capture that. Buber and Rosenzweig, you mentioned, were certainly in any inception that we have of friendship, very close. They worked together on various projects. Their families were intimate with one another, and yet they remained for 7 years on the more formal level when they would address one another as Z. And at one crucial moment, Rosenzweig was a very sick man, inadvertently, but perhaps not inadvertently, addressed Buber with the more intimate pronoun, du. And then he immediately apologized. But Buber said, after 7 years, we are perhaps indeed ready to address one another for du, with this more intimate pronoun. Then Rosenzweig accepted that and then added, but in my heart, I will continue to say Z out of respect. But it indicated that they developed trust. I often use an image borrowed from Karl Jaspers. Karl Jaspers says every human being, in order to protect himself, herself, develops sort of a shell. In German, a shell is called a Gehäuse, like a house, in which you protect yourself. And very reluctantly would you exit that shell. And as soon as there's a shadow of threat, you withdraw. But within this house, this Gehäuse, you're not fully exposed or present to the world. It takes a great deal of trust to exit that shell and not feel threatened by the other. That's the heart of, the I-Thou relationships.
I wanted to ask you with regard to, and this bears partly on the question of the I-Thou relationship, is that although Buber, it seems, in your beautiful depiction, is constantly in search of that deep dialogical connection, that he remains and wishes to remain as an outsider. One of the bonds that exists between him and Franz Rosenzweig is a distrust of the academy and a desire to avoid at almost all costs being sucked into the orbit of the traditional intellectual discipline. And this is captured in your title, A Life of Faith and Dissent. Now, looking at the titles in this Yale Jewish Lives series, one sees that there's always a second part of the title, but faith and dissent is such an interesting pairing because it suggests a desire to deeply belong, but also retains some aspect of critical distance. Is that an accurate depiction of his epistemology, and does it reflect part of the reason that he became particularly close colleague and collaborator of Franz Rosenzweig?
Yes. Just a word on faith. Faith as a concept or a posture undergoes a long history within the human odyssey. In traditional Judaism, as in Islam, faith means loyalty. In the modern period, captured by Kierkegaard, is a leap. You have to leap over here. your fears, anxieties, your, if you want to use a fancy word, epistemological uncertainties. For Buber, it denoted trust, which is interesting because even Franz, Moses Mendelssohn, who was yet just about on the end, on the threshold of the modern world, understood in his translations of the Jewish conception as trust. Of course, Buber gives it a strong existential significance. God created the world, and behold, it is good, and indeed very good. But if we pause, it's often riddled with pain, disappointment, and tragedy. And yet we're to affirm the goodness of the world. That is the arch of Jewish understanding of faith. But it means ultimately, as a religious concept, the trust that God is ultimately the ground of creation, despite its many difficulties. Trust. But going back to the image of the snail, we only exit our protective cover. It could be nationalism, could even be religious loyalty. It could be titles, professor or whatever, graduate student, ways we protect ourselves, the various persona, that mask that we enjoin in order to protect ourselves, the way we dress, the way we talk, etc. We have many, many strategies to protect ourselves. Trust allows us to really exit those, sort of to discard those protective coverings and postures in order to reach out to the other and to allow the other to enter our reality.
What role did dissent play in the development of his personal and philosophical orientation? You show him being an early, one could almost use the word apostle of Nietzsche, who wants the individual to defy arbitrary authority and define the fullest expression of self. But later on, he engages in deep studies of mysticism. He's an ardent Zionist, works closely for a time with Herzl. So he moves through periods and spheres of belonging. But he often, it seemed to me in reading your biography, comes to a place of dissent, even while he maintains a desire to uphold the importance of those movements on whose edge he maintains himself. So is dissent important to belonging and to faith?
Yeah. Dissent may be the wrong term, but hesitation, uncertainty, skepticism. He was always tentative in his attachments. And I didn't want to over-psychologize that tentativeness, but uncertainty. It perhaps goes back to his relation, to fail, the failure of his relationship to his mother. If I just can be a bit psychoanalytical, a mother's love is unconditional. She may be disappointed, may express anger, but one always returns to the mother as the bastion of one's life. He lacked that. He was a motherless child. And even in his first letter, which he to his wife, his future wife, the mother of his children, to acknowledge that her love, he concludes that letter where he accepts her love. Now I know what I've been looking for, a mother. Strange love letter.
Wow.
But a mother's the maternal warmth, solidity, ground, that allows one to proceed in the often treacherous reality we call life. And to the very end of his life, he regarded himself as a motherless child.
This is interesting, too, partly because it reflects how he views the role of women in the development of the Zionist project. I think particularly of the lectures he delivers to the Bar Kokhba group in Prague early on in his life, in which he addresses women specifically, but sort of, I want to say, confines their role to maternal the maternal task of not only giving birth to the nation, but of nourishing the home. Is that an accurate depiction? And how does his view of women's role in the Zionist project develop later on?
That's a very fine question. You should have told me beforehand so I could prepare you a more systematic and nuanced response. Women, the image of the woman, the reality of a woman's love, which was in some basic sense absent because of the disappearance, not only the disappearance of the mother, but she refused to acknowledge his cry, "Mama," and didn't turn around. He met her once, very much later in his life, where he introduced his children to her, and she couldn't look at her in the eyes. Couldn't. He self-betrayed. And amongst the very last things he did, or conversations that we have of his, is he asked a psychoanalyst whom he met, and what's the source of human anxiety? And she gave a Freudian response, and he said, "Well, I had a miserable childhood. I don't think that can explain the fundamental agony or uncertainty, existential uncertainty that has defined my life." And then she somehow, the psychoanalyst said, "Well, perhaps in a more basic sense is not to belong. Yes, I don't belong." He always saw himself as an outsider, which one, if wishes to be speculative, goes back to the fact that he lacked that sense of maternal home, if you could put it that way. This certitude that there's always a mother from whose breast you can seek sustenance, that he lacked. And therefore, relationships become increasingly important. He slowly develops an understanding that the heartbeat of a fulfilled life is our relationships. Someone just brought to my attention a letter that Saul Bellow wrote to a 14-year-old boy whose father passed away. And the letter is a beautiful letter. It says, "Your father," he tells the young man of 14, "understood the importance of relationships. He invested everything in friendship and the cultivation, nurturance of friendship. All else is somehow secondary. Fame, attainment, those are all protective, so to speak, necessary, of course, to make one's way in life." Well, actually, we found a poem of Buber's. He said, "Fame," an 86-year-old man, he died at 87. He would often write little poems, very simple. I can translate it. "Fame is an odd thing, but it does provide some some gratification." But it was obviously ironic. He was a very famous man. He had a very noble countenance. Even that has a story. At birth, there was an accident in which the forceps, yes, forgive me, twisted a lower lip. And he, as a child, he always had a distorted lip and somewhat of a distorted speech. As soon as he was able to grow a mustache, he did that. It didn't quite do the trick, so he did a beard to cover up this deformity. It wasn't meant to project an image of being a prophet, but later on he was so regarded, and he said, "Well, why not?"
Skipping a little bit in his biography, it seems as though National Socialism comes to power in Germany, his wife Paula almost immediately apprehends the severity of the existential challenge to Jewish life in Germany and in Europe. And Buber doesn't. Buber thinks it's a transitional or transitory phase that can be overcome, especially if the Germanness of the Jewish population is made clear in Germany. But he comes to understand Nazism as representing an assault not only on the Jewish community, but on the life of the spirit. How does this become clear to him, and what does he do about it?
Very well. I must compliment you before your radio audience that you're a good reader.
Thank you. You taught me well.
It's true. His wife, who was not born a Jew, and she eventually converted, and she had a greater attentiveness to the German spirit and its wiles, and perhaps its inclination to barbarity. He refused to see that initially, and put great trust in the Weimar Republic and in democracy. But within a few months, he realized that vision, that hope, that confidence was shattered. Buber had an existential commitment, though, to, as many Jews, to the efficacy of rational discourse, to the Enlightenment. Should the Enlightenment fail us, then, to put it in American language, then we're in trouble. and he refused to do that. Even when he eventually confronted the conflict, the seemingly intractable conflict between the Zionist settlement in Palestine and the Arabs, he ultimately felt obliged to affirm the vision of Book of Genesis. God created the world. Behold, it is good, indeed, very good. That is a matter of faith. So that's the title of the book, is A Life of Faith and Descent. But a faith which is not naive, but faith that wishes to exit the shell that we create as individuals and as in peoples, nations, political formations, in order to live a life of faith, trust that the world is ultimately good. Not a naive affirmation of the world is good, but accept the challenge. If I may just allow me, I recently published, forgive me for doing that way, but an article on Gnostic anxieties. In the wake of the First World War, particularly in Germany, where everything collapsed, there was a marked retreat from the Enlightenment and this vision of humanity. And many scholars in the wake of the First World War, amongst them very great, significant liberal thinkers, such as Adolf von Hammer, who was considered the liberal Christian theologian, turned to Gnosticism. Gnosticism suggests, and it's a school of thought, many different branches, but it's generally speaking, has some characteristics. The world we live in is inherently awful. And ultimately, it's not where we human beings, as spiritual, destined to be spiritual beings, belong. So Gnosticism comes from the Greek word for knowledge. We know it from the word agnostic, I don't know. But Gnosis means sort of arcane knowledge, salvific knowledge that we are able to grasp that knowledge, attain that knowledge. We free our souls from the incarceration in this material world, which is inherently compromises our dignity. And that also had its political correlation. Buber and many other Jewish thinkers, but particularly Buber, was wary of a Gnostic turn. He understood the temptation, but we must resist Gnosticism and affirm the world of creation. Towards the end of the Weimar Republic, Buber, together with similarly minded Christian thinkers, established a journal called Creatur, the Poor Creatures. Creatures with a responsibility to assure that this is God's world, God's creation. And that remained a motif in Buber's life. Despite all the tragedy and disappointments, that often that we are betrayed by our families, in this case his mother, we have to affirm life.
Somewhat related to that, there's so much in this book that I wanted to cover, and it would be fun to interview you for 3 hours, but our listeners would abandon us. But Related to that is, in my mind at least, is the meeting that that is facilitated and in which Buber eagerly participates in the mid-late 1950s, I believe, with the German philosopher Martin Heidegger. It seems as though in your book, as I recall, you suggest that part of the philosophical turn represented by Heidegger is a reaction against or to the massive destruction and dislocation of World War I and the view that Buber maintains of the essence of the dialogical nature and purpose of relationship as represented in language is something that Heidegger abandons, and that Heidegger undermines the humanistic philosophical tradition of continental philosophy. But the fact that they even meet is rather astonishing, and his friends took him to task for that. What was the significance of that meeting with Martin Heidegger, and what if any lasting effect did it have on Buber, on Buber's view of Heidegger's philosophy?
Again, that will require a seminar in and of itself on a variety of levels, philosophical as well as existential and perhaps even psychological, because Heidegger was known to have initially endorsed Nazism. And we even have witnesses that even at the end of the war, Heidegger still had in his lapel a swastika. And that raises questions whether he, although he had ultimately some reservations about Hitler, but the Nazi vision somehow still spoke to him. So why would a good Jewish boy, even as he aged, seek to have a relationship, even an intellectual relationship, with Heidegger? Of course, it's not only true of Buber and Hannah Arendt, but others. Heidegger seemed to establish a whole new way of understanding the human journey, and in a sense brought us back to questions of ontology as opposed to epistemology, which means how we know the world, how we are able to organize the world in its material, objective sense. Is this a table or is this a mic? Are these glasses which I'm wearing as opposed to your earmuffs, which I, the earphones that you're wearing. And of course, epistemology became very important in the sense that we should not just be baffled by the world, but the world has a structure, and if we're able to understand the structure, we can move it ahead and redesign certain features such to the betterment of humankind. But eclipsed of that, what is eclipsed by that, almost singular focus on epistemology was the questions of the meaning of life. And those questions became more poignant, particularly pointing to the collapse of what seemed to be the collapse of the Enlightenment and the liberal project in the wake of the First World War. And that is understood as a return to ontology. What is the nature of human being? And that was Heidegger's question, and it was and Buber, as many of his generation, appreciated that turn. Although Buber was not very satisfied by Heidegger's approach to answering that question, and turn to what we call philosophical anthropology. What is a human being? And all the permutations of what it means to be a human being or to give expression to our humanity, which contradict Heidegger's approach without going into the details. But after the war, the opportunity arose to meet with Heidegger and to discuss the issues of language, speech. Is language the only vehicle in which we relate to one another, and how? And they did meet in a clandestine fashion, secretly, but it was Buber's initiative, which Heidegger accepted. And that just baffles us. But Buber wanted to probe, so it seems, Heidegger, why he turned to Nazism to address these questions or to deal with these questions. And it seemed that he eventually felt that Heidegger was not prepared to make that discussion, and basically withdrew. Nonetheless, leads the question of why Buber was so crucial for Buber to to meet with Heidegger and to redress these questions. But Heidegger's philosophy had a magical, if you wish, pull on a whole generation, also Jewish, particularly Jewish thinkers. Mm-hmm.
But Buber was not one.
No, but he appreciated the questions of Heidegger, and he kept on returning to the questions of Heidegger. And it helped Buber give focus to his own quest to understand what is human being.
Buber emigrates to Palestine in 1938. He becomes a professor at Hebrew University, and he immediately sees the massive problem of how the Zionist project is approaching the Arab population. And he becomes somewhat it's an understatement to say he becomes a controversial figure, because he urges rapprochement and community building with the Arab community in Palestine. How does that, and this seems consistent with his desire for fully meeting the other, mm-hmm. how does this affect how he is seen in Palestine in the emerging state of Israel?
Yeah. Of course, even before he emigrated to Palestine, he had misgivings about certain direction that the Zionist movement had taken. It also goes back to his relationship to Herzl. Zionism is a coat of many colors, such as Judaism and human life in general. But Zionism had many colors, and he was associated with the Zionism that was less concerned with political advancement of Jewish needs, particularly as focused on attaining a sovereign political home, initially anywhere, but ultimately in Palestine. And it's known as political Zionism. He was never really a follower of political Zionism. It was roughly called cultural Zionism. Zionism is a way of renewing Judaism such that it addresses the modern condition, the way we now think about the world and the like. We have a much more universal, cosmopolitan compass to what we consider to be thought and human relationships. Sometimes it's called spiritual Zionism. And within that, there are all sorts of configurations. But Buber was basically a spiritual Zionist, wary of political Zionism. It was never his concern. And he was wary of the entrapments of what we ultimately call realpolitik, using the ruthlessness and often deceits and to attain political goals. Mm-hmm. And he felt that that approach can also vitiate the more spiritual ambition might be the wrong word, a vision of Zionism, which he remained more or less attuned to with constantly revising his understanding of what the spiritual renewal would be. And the great test of that was the conflict with the Palestinians. The Palestinians were living in Palestine. Almost sounds like a tautology, but they were Arabs living in Palestine for centuries, and they were the majority population of the British Mandate. Mandate being what Great Britain was granted tutelage of area known as Palestine after the First World War, granted by Western powers, not with the consent of the local population. And within that context, the British gave a certain mandate to the Zionist organization, not sovereignty, but establish a homeland, however that may be defined, within Palestine, much to the chagrin of course, the local population. Buber understood that chagrin, which Britain and the Zionist leadership sought to ignore. And Buber said, we can't, on a variety of politically we can't, and also humanly we can't ignore the fact that there is a Palestinian population, and that at least at that time, up until the establishment of the State of Israel, they were a majority population living there in the land for centuries, not as outsiders, not as foreigners, but an indigenous population. The conflict, to say this in broad terms, a political conflict and thus ultimately a military conflict with the Palestinians would even given the exigencies of the Holocaust, the Nazism, would only emasculate, defame, undermine the spiritual objectives, if you wish, or visions of Zionism. Buber was not opposed to Jewish settlement in Palestine, but it should be in a way which does not undermine or challenge Palestinian sensibilities and rights. And that was a very difficult formula, of course.
How should we read Buber today? What, in an era of resurgent nationalism and divisions between individuals and community, what is his writing telling us today? And if you were to send us to particular works of his, which works would you suggest?
Right. I think it would be a disservice to Buber and to ourselves if we read Buber as hagiographically as a saint. He himself went through many, many revisions. And constantly revised his understanding of himself and others and the Zionist project. But what remained, so to speak, the lodestar was that we have to learn somehow to live with one another with dignity, mutual dignity. And that led him to seek how we can do such. He urged us, and even in his own writings, never to think in a doctrinal fashion, constantly revise our understanding of a given situation. Buber's been compared to what we often call situational ethics. The situation determines how we respond. Of course, that's not quite, well, because Buber had principles which were independent of the situation, but they always must be adjusted to the situation. And that's what he calls dialogue. Dialogue with our fellow human beings and dialogues with the situations in which we find ourselves. Dialogue is difficult. We can often have mis-meetings. We often can misunderstand ourselves as well as the other with whom we are engaged. But dialogue is the, and there is an openness to our inner selves as well as the other, the dynamic that is crucial. The religious aspect, where you do call it the book of life of faith and dialogue and dissent, and that is ultimately to affirm the goodness of life, the possibilities of life. Someone would ask me, what is Jewish about Pio Buber's life, thought? Perhaps that is the ultimate. This he shared with his friend Franz Rosenzweig, was also deeply alert to the tragic fibers or texture of life, the difficulties we all confront with ourselves and others, sometimes brutal, sometimes simply a question of misunderstanding, but nonetheless... Rosenzweig says at one point, what is the most hurtful thing in life is to be misperceived. And that's probably true of all of us. However, Rosenzweig also concludes his book, The Star of Redemption, with two words. In life, we're not to retreat from life. Or as we simply say, almost in a trivial fashion, l'chaim, to life. With full awareness of life is, the ultimate signature of life is our death, which is obviously the great enigma and great pain, but within the bounds of that, our finitude, we affirm life.
And speaking of affirming life, you are concluding a phase of your long and extremely productive career. You are... mere days away from retirement from the University of Chicago. You live in Israel. And I wonder if you can tell us what is next for you, what other projects you're going to be working on, and what your intellectual focus will be.
Actually, you've been retired as of December 31st. But prior to that, as perhaps you should have mentioned, I was a member of the Hebrew University faculty for 30 years, so I have dual retirement. In Israel, we have mandatory retirement, and in the United States, you can reach senility and still be a professor. I don't know if that's a judgment that I'm senile or not, but let me just say that that question was raised to a great German historian, Theodor Mommsen, and when he reached the age of 80, he was asked, Professor Mommsen, will you continue to write? He said, yes, I do. I have various projects, but the question is whether I will still learn. And Hannah Arendt, if I just apropos that comment, who had a very judgmental view of the world, and particularly of fellow human beings, had a notebook, like an address book, in which he wrote down the address, but with comments about people. They were often brutal, harsh. But when it came to Buber, he says, what is the virtue of Buber? He's still open-minded. He, not like all the other Yekes, I think. He's still willing to reassess what he thinks. That is to say, he's still able to learn. And I hope I'm still able to learn. I have a lot of things I want to write, but that isn't necessarily as rehashing or developing things I've already been working on, but whether I still can learn. And what is, it's now 6 months or so that I've no longer teach. One of the beauties of, and I can use that word, edifying beauties, if you wish, of teaching is that in discourse with younger people or students, one is challenged to rethink. Buber's teacher, Georg Simmel, once asked a student on a doctoral exam, surprising, what it means to think. The student had prepared, text on Hegel and Schmegel and like, it was the only question he asked, what does it mean to think? And then Simmel said later on, I'll say in German, Denken tut weh, thinking hurts, it's hard. I do hope to have the courage to go through the pain of thinking, not simply rehashing or re-editing or recycling whatever I have written before, but to think with all the pain that comes from that is attendant to genuine thought.
Well, you have greatly enhanced our capacity to think with your, which I should mention, not only through your writing, but through your compassionate teaching and mentorship too, which many of your students have spoken about. My guest today has been Paul Mendes-Flohr, formerly of the Hebrew University and the University of Chicago, the author of Martin Buber, A Life of Faith and Dissent. Professor Mendes-Flohr, thank you so much for sitting and speaking with me today.
You're more than welcome. Thank you.